Day 180, GC Standard 306. The Wane. Seated safely behind the window in their quarters, Ohan gazed into the black hole. With some effort, they could remember how the galaxy had looked during their host's childhood, before infection. Flat, vacant, blank. So much of existence was lost to a mind untouched by the Whisperer. Their alien companions had such minds. Ohan pitied them. Looking only with their eyes, Ohan's view of the activity taking place along the edges of the black hole's accretion disk was no different from the way the rest of the crew saw it. A flock of unmanned skimmer drones sailed as close as they could safely get to the event horizon, just on the edge of gravity's embrace. They drifted through the whirling silt, and to the ordinary observer, they would appear to be doing nothing but drawing dust trails with their comb-like arms. But if Ohan looked with their mind, mapped it all out with the right numbers and notions, the space outside became a majestic, violent place. Around the skimmer's arms, raw energy tumbled and boiled, like a thrashing sea churning up flotsam. Tendrils of the stuff curled up around the combs, arching and writhing as they were coaxed into the collection hoppers. Or so Ohan imagined. They pressed close to the window, in awe of the storm that lay beyond sight. And again, they thought of what their crewmates would see. An empty patch of space, blacker than black, and little skimmers collecting invisible cargo. How still the universe must look to their eyes, Ohan thought. How silent. That invisible cargo was what their captain had come to purchase. Ashby was probably haggling over the price of ambi cells at that very moment. Raw ambi, the stuff Ohan envisioned torquing around the skimmer combs, was difficult to gather. Ambi could be found everywhere and in everything, but the way that it weaved itself around ordinary matter made extracting it a troublesome task. With the right technology, it could be wrenched apart, but the process was so tedious and reaped such small rewards that it wasn't worth the effort. It was far easier to gather ambi somewhere where matter was already being ripped apart by forces greater than anything any sapient could build. Like a black hole. Black holes were always surrounded by turbulent seas of free-floating ambi, but getting close enough to gather it posed an obvious risk. For ambi traders, the risk was worth it, especially since it allowed them to charge a premium. As expensive as ambi cells were, they were the only thing that could power the wayfarer's interspatial bore. It was a necessary expense for a ship such as theirs, but one that always left Ashby looking a little gray afterwards. Ohan had read of ships powered entirely by ambi cells, but they had trouble conceiving of a life in which such an extravagance was affordable. Ohan picked up the razor that lay beside the washbasin near their feet. They clicked a skipping rhythm with their tongue as they trimmed the patterns in their fur. The swirls of fur and clicks of tongue meant nothing to their crewmates, but they meant everything to Ohan. Every pattern represented a cosmological truth, every series of clicks an abstraction of the universe's underlying mathematics. These were symbols and sounds every Cyanet pair knew. They wore the layers of the universe upon their skin, drummed its beat with their mouths. A sharp twinge blossomed deep within their wrist, and for a moment, the pair lost control of their hand. The razor slipped, nicking their skin. Ohan chirped, more out of surprise than pain. They wrapped the fingers of their other hand round the wound, rocking back and forth for a moment as the feeling faded to a quiet burn. Ohan exhaled. They looked down to the cut. Thin blood oozed forth, matting a tiny patch of fur. But the razor had not gone deep. Ohan stood stiffly, and walked to the dresser in search of a bandage. This was the first stage of the wane, stiffness and muscle spasms. Eventually, the pain would spread to their bones, and their muscles would become increasingly difficult to control. The pain would then disappear completely, but this was a devious mercy, as it indicated that their nerve fibers had begun to die. Death would come afterward, in its own time. The wane was an inevitability in a sign that pairs life. Though the Whisperer unlocked the mind of the host, it also shortened their life. Solitaries, blasphemous hosts that avoided infection, a crime punished by exile, reportedly could live well over 100 standards, but no pair had ever lived to be more than 30. From time to time, alien doctors would come forward, offering to help cure the wane, but they were always refused. There could be no chance of a treatment damaging the genetic stability of the Whisperer. The infection was sacred. It could not be tampered with. The wane was a fair price to pay for enlightenment. Even so, Ohan was afraid. They could disconnect themselves from the fear, but it lingered, like an unpleasant taste in the back of the throat. Fear. Such a throwback emotion, meant to spur primitive life forms away from potential predators. Life's universal constant. Every fear of rejection, of criticism, of failure, of loss, these were all caused by that same archaic survival reflex. Ohan knew that their own fear of death was nothing more than some primitive synapses firing within their host's brain, the emotional equivalent of jerking a hand away from a hot surface. When they reached for the higher parts of their mind, they knew that death was nothing to fear. Why should they fear something that came to all life forms? In some ways, having reached the wane was a comfort to Ohan. It meant that they had been successful in avoiding a sudden, premature end. Ashby and Dr. Sheff were the only ones who knew that Ohan had begun to wane. The captain attempted to carry on as normal, though he often asked Ohan in a hushed voice how they were feeling, if there was anything he could do. Dr. Sheff, kind creature that he was, had taken the trouble to contact Cyanet doctors to learn more about the wane's effects. A few days after the wayfarer left Coriel, Dr. Sheff had presented Ohan with a variety of homemade tinctures and teas made from herbs recommended for easing the pain. Ohan had been touched, though as always, they did not know how to adequately express their thanks. Gift-giving was unheard of in Cyanet culture, and Ohan were always ill-equipped to express gratitude for such gestures. They believed that Dr. Sheff understood this social limitation. In a way, Dr. Sheff could see into the hearts of others as well as Ohan themselves could see the universe. Ohan often wondered if Dr. Sheff knew what a gift that was. Bandage in place and blood cleaned away, Ohan returned to the window. They picked up the razor, clicking their cheek as they dragged the blade through their fur. As they did so, they thought of the concept of purpose. Dr. Sheff's purpose was to heal and nourish. Ashby's purpose was to bind his crew together. Accepting the wane ran contrary to those purposes. For them, accepting the death of a crew member was difficult. Ohan hoped they knew how much the effort was appreciated. Ohan's own purpose was to be a navigator, to unveil the universe for those who were blind to it. After death, Ohan would no longer be able to pursue that purpose, and they could not deny that this saddened them. At least there would be time for one more job, this new tunnel at Hedraka. The wane had only begun its first stage. There was time for a tunnel before succumbing. Ohan hoped that Ashby was not uncomfortable with letting them embrace the wane's final stage aboard the Wayfarer. They could think of nothing more fitting than dying in the place that housed their purpose. Ohan looked again into the black hole. They closed their eyes and pictured great swathes of fragmented matter falling and pressing endlessly. Larab, they would call it in their native tongue, a word to describe form, and grus, too, a word for the color of unseen matter. There were no words in Klip for the colors of shapes that lay beyond sight. They had tried at times to explain these things to the wayfarer's crew, but there were no words, no abstractions that could open their crewmates' limited minds. Ohan preferred to take in the sight alone, especially now. A black hole was the perfect place to contemplate death. There was nothing in the universe that could last forever. Not stars, not matter, nothing. The razor cut. Their wrist ached. The sky roiled, unseen. Feed source. Reskitt Museum of Natural Sciences. Archival Library. Public. Reskitkish. Item name. Thoughts on the Galaxy. Chapter 3. Author. Oshet Tekshereket. Est. Raist. Us. Eas. Kirish. Isket. Ish. Kriset. Encryption. 0. Translation path. Reskitkish. Klip. Transcription. 0. Node identifier. 9874457 28. Rosemary Harper. When meeting an individual of another species for the first time, there is no sapient in the galaxy who does not immediately take inventory of their psychological differences. These are always the first things we see. How does their skin differ? Does Z have a tail? How does Z move? How does Z pick things up? What does Z eat? Does Z have abilities that I don't, or vice versa? These are all important distinctions, but the more important comparison is the one we make after this point. Once we've made our mental checklists of variations, we begin to draw parallels, not between the alien and ourselves, but between the alien and animals. The majority of us have been taught since childhood that voicing these comparisons is derogatory, and indeed, many of the racial slurs in colloquial use are nothing more than common names for non-sapient species. For example, the human term lizard to describe andrisks, the Quellen term tick to describe humans, the andrisk term search to describe Quellen. Though these terms are offensive, examining them objectively reveals a point of major biological interest. All demeaning implications aside, we andrisks do look like some of the native reptilian species of Earth. Humans do look like larger, bipedal versions of the hairless primates that plague the sewer systems of Quellen cities. Quellen do bear some resemblance to the snapping crustaceans found all over Hashkath. And yet, we evolved separately, and on different worlds. My people and the lizards of Earth do not share an evolutionary tree, nor do humans and ticks, nor Quellen and Sersh. Our points of origin are spread out across the galaxy. We hail from systems that remained self-contained for billions of years, with evolutionary clocks that all began at different times. How is it possible that when meeting our galactic neighbors for the first time, we are all instantly reminded of creatures back home, or in some cases, of ourselves? The question becomes even more complicated when we start to look beyond our superficial differences to the wealth of similarities. All sapient species have brains. Let us consider that seemingly obvious fact for a moment. Despite our isolated evolutionary paths, we all developed nervous systems with a central hub. We all have internal organs. We all share at least some of the same physical senses: hearing, touch, taste, smell, sight, electroreception. The grand majority of sapiens have either 4 or 6 limbs. Bipedalism and opposable digits, while not universal, are shockingly common. We are all made from chromosomes and DNA, which themselves are made from a select handful of key elements. We all require a steady intake of water and oxygen to survive, though in varying quantities. We all need food. We all buckle under atmospheres too thick or gravitational fields too strong. We all die in freezing cold or burning heat. We all die, full stop. How can this be? How is it that life, so diverse on the surface, has followed the same patterns throughout the galaxy, not just in the current era, but over and over again? We see this pattern in the ruins of the Arcanic civilization at Shesha, or the ancient fossil beds on the now barren world of Okik. This is a question that scientific communities have wrestled with for centuries, and it seems unlikely that an answer will present itself in the near future. There are many theories: asteroids carrying amino acids, supernovae blowing organic material out into neighboring systems, and yes, there is the fanciful story of a hyper-advanced sapient race seeding the galaxy with genetic material. I admit that the galactic gardener hypothesis has fueled the plots of some of my favorite science fiction sims, but scientifically speaking, it is nothing more than wishful thinking. You cannot have a theory without evidence, and there is absolutely none that supports this idea, no matter what the conspiracy theorists lurking on linking feeds would have you believe. For my part, I think that the best explanation is the simplest one. The galaxy is a place of laws. Gravity follows laws. The life cycles of stars and planetary systems follow laws. Subatomic particles follow laws. We know the exact conditions that will cause the formation of a red dwarf, or a comet, or a black hole. Why, then, can we not acknowledge that the universe follows similarly rigid laws of biology? We have only ever discovered life on similarly sized terrestrial moons and planets, orbiting within a narrow margin round hospitable stars. If we all evolved on such kindred worlds, why is it such a surprise that our evolutionary paths have so much in common? Why can we not conclude that the right combination of specific environmental factors will always result in predictable physical adaptations? With so much evidence staring us in the face, why does this debate continue? The answer, of course, is that the laws of biology are nearly impossible to test, and scientists hate that. We can launch probes to test theories of gravity and space-time. We can put rocks in pressure cookers and split atoms in classrooms. But how does one test a process as lengthy and multifaceted as evolution? There are labs today that struggle to find the funding to keep a project running for 3 standards. Imagine the funding needed to run a project for millennia. As it stands, there is no way for us to efficiently test the conditions that produce specific biological adaptations beyond the most rudimentary observations. Aquatic climates produce fins, cold climates produce fur or blubber, and so on. There have been bold attempts at creating software that could accurately predict evolutionary paths, such as the Aeluon-funded TEP-PREME project, which, though well-intentioned, has yet to unravel the mysteries of biological law. The problem with such endeavors is that there are too many variables to consider, many of which we remain ignorant of. We simply don't have enough data, and the data that we do possess is still beyond our understanding. We are experts of the physical galaxy. We live on terraformed worlds and in massive orbital habitats. We tunnel through the sublayer to hop between stellar systems. We escape planetary gravity with the ease of walking out the front door. But when it comes to evolution, we are hatchlings, fumbling with toys. I believe this is why many of my peers still cling to theories of genetic material scattered by asteroids and supernovae. In many ways, the idea of a shared stock of genes drifting through the galaxy is far easier to accept than the daunting notion that none of us may ever have the intellectual capacity to understand how life truly works.